Have you ever done something and then immediately after you've done it said, why'd I do that? Probably all have from time to time. You know, maybe it's something silly. Maybe having a bowl of soup, you know, for lunch or something like that. You finish your bowl of soup and when you're done, you walk over and you take your dirty bowl and you stick it up in a cabinet and you start to walk away and say, why'd I do that for? It's a dirty bowl. It's supposed to go in the sink or in the dishwasher. Now, we've probably all done silly things like that hundreds of times, and most of the time it is something silly and innocuous, doesn't really matter a whole lot. You know, other times it has a little more serious consequences. Once upon a time, I was helping a friend of mine change a water pump on his car. And so we got the water pump off of his car, and we had everything we needed except the new water pump. It was all, you know, taken apart, ready to put the new one on. We had to run to the store and get the water pump. We got there and come to find out there were two different styles of water pump on that particular car. And the only way to know which one that you had was to compare it to the old pump. Well, the difference was so subtle, you really had to be able to look at the other one to know the difference. So we took a guess on which one we needed, got back to his house, and guess what? We chose poorly. You know, and so we had to go back, make another trip, and get the right pump. But, you know, as soon as I got to the, actually, as soon as we were at the store, and the technician there behind the counter asked me which pump it was, you know, it just dawned on me, duh, you know, why didn't I just bring the old water pump with me? It would have been easy. So, you know, not a big consequence, but it took more time to have to run back to the store, make two trips like that. But, you know, we've probably all done that. And if we're honest, we've probably done it in much more serious situations. Maybe we've committed a sin, and we knew that we shouldn't do it, but we succumb to the temptation, and we do. And as soon as we do, we say, why did I do that? You know, why did I succumb to that temptation? Well, that's what I want to talk about today. You know, why do we succumb to such temptations? I'd like for us to ask that and answer that question. Why do we sin when we know it's a sin? If you like titles, I'm simply using the title today, why'd I do that? You know, why did I do that? Now, our purpose today isn't to define sin. Like, we know what sin is. It's the transgression of the law. And we can talk about different types of sin. We talked in depth on Wednesday night, for those of you who were able to join us on the Bible study. For those of you who did not, that will be posted here shortly. But we talked about different types of sins. You've heard the term the sin of commission or the sin of omission. It's not necessarily a biblical term, but I think it's a accurate enough sort of term. A sin of commission is something that when we make an act of some sort and we sin. Whereas a sin of omission is maybe we neglect to do something we should have. You know, new person comes to visit a church and maybe we don't take the time to make them feel welcome as we should. And we talked about what's written there in Psalm 19, a presumptuous sin. Presumptuous sin is really what we're talking about today. And if we're honest with ourselves, for those of us that have been baptized and received God's Holy Spirit, you know, that's all sin. A presumptuous sin is when I know it's a sin, I recognize it's wrong, but I do it anyway. You know, few and far between are sins that we don't know about. You know, I mean, I think back years ago, when my parents first came to church, they didn't realize that there were clean and unclean meats, things you shouldn't eat. You know, that wasn't a presumptuous sin, they just didn't know. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about our lives here today that we're actually living now. Things that we know we shouldn't do, yet we do. Why do we do them? Why do we do them? Now, I don't think too many of us have been in a situation where, you know, you said, you know what, I really am upset with this person. I can't stand them anymore. I am going to plan a murder and kill them. That's a very presumptuous sin. You know, it's premeditated murder. But perhaps we've done other things where we've gotten a little bit more desperate and we realize, well, we're tight on money, and so maybe I'm going to do something I shouldn't, maybe not tithe. You know, I doubt many people have gotten to the point where they're so tight on money that they went out and robbed a bank. Although, actually, I do know of a person who did that many years ago, back in the 80s, 90s, somewhere in there. A baptized member of God's church, got desperate for money, committed armed robbery, and wound up going to jail for it. So, you know, we go through things, temptations, that lead us to sin. So what are those? Why does that happen? You know, this presumptuous type sin can be a lot of different things. You know, again, there's the big obvious examples to be tempted, you know, sexually and go commit adultery. But by and large, those are the things that, not the types of things we deal with on a daily basis. You know, taking a paperclip from work, that's still a presumptuous sin. We know better than to do that. Or saying, you know what, I know I really shouldn't watch this video on the internet because I know it contains pornography, but man, it looks so good. Or wow, you know, I know that I really got to watch my, you know, what I eat and everything because I've got some health issues, but boy, I'm tempted by that bowl of ice cream, or maybe money's tight, so I'm just going to back off on tithing for a little while, just until I can get even again, you know, just so I can get up to where I need to be, and then I can resume tithing. You know, we find ways to justify what we want to do. I know I actually worked with a guy, a wise older gentleman. I was a young buck in the engineering department, and he was just a couple years from retirement, and he would often say that too, all of us young men there. He'd say, you know, you can justify anything you want. All of us who are human beings and have human nature, you know, I think we've realized that to be true. We've found ways to justify just about anything we want to do. And then later on, we look back and say, why'd I do that? You know, I knew it was wrong. I knew it was sinful, but I did it anyway. Well, what causes us to sin? I think the definitive writing on that is actually in the book of James. James chapter 1, starting in verse 14. This is often referred to as the sin cycle, how sin occurs in our life. James 1. Starting in verse 14. James writes, says, but each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Then, when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death. So here we see this cycle. We have a lust for something, and that desire, that lust for something, grows so strong it leads us to an action, a sinful action. You know, lust is often associated with sexual desire, but that's not all it's limited to. It can be a lust really for anything. You know, maybe I want a promotion at work, so I'll talk nasty about my coworkers and go to the boss behind their back and say things about them because I want to get the promotion. You know, I'm lusting for that promotion. You know, maybe lust is for that new TV or the new car or whatever. And so we decide, well, I'm going to, you know, stop tithing for a while so I can go out and buy this thing. Although, honestly, the more likely scenario in that regard isn't that we decide that we're going to stop tithing to go buy something. It's that we lust for something. You know, we go out and buy it, maybe on a credit card, and when the bill comes due, we realize, oh, wait, I can't pay this. So, well, I won't pay my tithe until I get this bill paid off. And also kind of happens the other way around, but it's the same principle. Now, it's worth noting that simply desiring to have something is not sinful. You know, if a position at work comes open, a promotion, it's not wrong to want that. It's not wrong to go to your boss and say, hey, you know, I'd like to be considered for this position. It's wrong to start saying bad things about people to try to get it. You know, it's not wrong to want a TV. It's not wrong to want a new car. You know, if we look at our finances and say, okay, well, you know, if I, you know, maybe cut back on what I'm spending on going out to eat, you know, every week, and I save some money here and I save some money there, I can afford that new TV, or I can afford a down payment on the car and make the monthly payments. It's not wrong to have desire. Desire in and of itself is not a bad thing. understanding that, then I think we can come up with a better definition of lust, and that is this. Lust is wanting or desiring something so badly that you're willing to sin for it. It's wanting or desiring something so badly that you're willing to sin for it. Or as the old fella that I worked with said, you can justify whatever you want. You know, justify acting in a sinful way to get what you want. You know, starting rumors about other people is sinful. You know, explaining to your boss that, hey, I'd like to be considered this position is not. That's not a sin, so that's not. Telling someone that you're interested in a position is not sinful, so that's not lust. That's just saying, hey, I have this desire. So perhaps we could come up with a better definition of lust, but that's what we'll use as our working definition for today. So James tells us that lust, or this desire that's so strong that leads us to sin, is what leads us to sin. It's what causes us to sin. So the next logical question is, well, what makes us want to lust then? Why do we lust? What are the reasons behind our lust? Again, I think it's more than just a desire. I mean, you could say, well, what causes us to lust? It's desire. What causes us desire? Well, it's lust. You know, you can come up with a circular sort of logic here if you're not careful. But what causes us to lust? The Apostle John, I think, gives us a definitive statement on this, and that's found in 1 John 2, verse 16. Let's turn there. 1 John 2. Verse 16. John writes this. It says, for all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. Here we see John give three things. He summarizes three things that cause us to lust. Lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. Now perhaps we could debate and come up with other sources of lust, but here we have a biblical guide and definition from the Apostle John, one who learned directly from Jesus Christ on what causes us to lust. So I'd like to explore these three causes of lust today in the remainder of this message. Let's begin with the very first one, the lust of the flesh. Now, many times people think of this and they think of it's talking about sexual desire, you know, lust for a woman or for, you know, lust for man or whatever. And that's actually not what the lust of the flesh is. We'll talk about that in the next source of lust. But the lust of the flesh has really more to do with one's self-interest, self-preservation. You know, being concerned with yourself, your own flesh, first. As we might say in modern vernacular, looking out for, you know, numero uno, right? Or, you know, saving your own skin, taking care of yourself. It's characterized by selfishness and contempt for fellow man. It could be seen as the root cause of slavery or disrespect or despising the poor. So we'll define this as being concerned mostly about yourself. I'm going to read about an example of this. You can probably think of dozens of examples, but we're going to read one back in the book of Judges. Judges 19. You can begin turning there. Judges 19. This is perhaps one of the more peculiar stories in the Old Testament. It involves a man. It involves his concubine. It involves her being raped, him almost being raped, and then the subsequent annihilation, near annihilation, of an entire tribe of Israel. So let's go through the story. Won't read it all for sake of time, but let's go through it here. In Judges 19, verse 1, it says, and it came to pass in those days, when there was no king in Israel, that there was a certain Levite staying in the remote mountains of Ephraim. He took for himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah, But his concubine played the harlot against him and went away from him to her father's house at Bethlehem in Judah, and she was there 4 months. Then her husband arose and went after her to speak kindly to her and bring her back, having his servant and a couple of donkeys with him. So he brought him to her father's house, and when the father of the young woman saw him, he was glad to meet him. Now his father-in-law, the young man's father, detained him, and he stayed with him 3 days. So they ate and drank and lodged there. Now there's a debate amongst some about the relationship here. You know, a lot of times we hear the word concubine, and we think about King Solomon. You know, he had 700 wives and 300 concubines, and we think of those as girlfriends or prostitutes. But it can also be translated as this was his fiancée. I think that's probably the more likely translation here in this story. This man, this Levite, was engaged to this woman. She went out and played the harlot. Now, does that mean she was sleeping with other people, or does that mean she was trying to break off the engagement? Again, we don't know, and we don't want to get too caught up in the judgment. But I just want to make sure we don't just look at, you know, him or her as the bad guy and just presume a judgment upon them. So it seems they were likely engaged to be married. He goes back, talks to her, says he speaks kindly to her. Seems that they patch things up fairly well. They go back to her father's house, and they stay there for 3 days. Now, in verses 5 through 11, you can read that again later on. It talks about how each day they go to leave and the father-in-law says, well, just wait a little bit longer and wait a little bit longer. And what winds up happening is they wind up till they leave late in the day. And because they do that, they really can't travel as far as they need to. And they kind of get stuck between where they are and where they need to go. Now, it took them a long time to say goodbye, not unlike it does here in the South. You know, you start to leave, you go to somebody's house for dinner, you start to leave, and an hour and a half later, you're still out in the driveway talking. You know, so I think we can all relate to that. That's kind of what's going on here. So the man goes to travel. He wants to stop one place, and that doesn't look very good. And the servant wants to stop there, and the master says, no, that's not a good place for us to be. Pick up the story in verse 12. It says, but his master said to him, we will not turn aside here into a city of foreigners who are not of the children of Israel. We will go on to Gibeah. So he said this to his servant, come, let us draw near to one of these places and spend the night in Gibeah or in Ramah. And they passed by and went their way. And the sun went down on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin. So this was in a time when the promised land wasn't quite settled. Okay, it wasn't just that Israel was a unified nation and a mighty kingdom like it would be later under Saul and David and Solomon. They were still possessing the land at this time, and so it was kind of some good areas and some bad areas. But they stop in this town, Gibeah, and then this town was controlled by Benjaminites, a fellow tribe of Israel. This man was a Levite, and so you see that the Benjaminites controlled this town. So it would be a friendly town, or so you would assume. Verse 15 says, they turned aside there to go into the lodge in Gibeah. And when he went in, he sat down in the open square of the city, for no one would take them into his house to spend the night. Now this might sound like an innocent phrase, but again, we have to consider the times. You know, it wasn't just a Holiday Inn that you could check into. You know, this town, the land, was kind of hit or miss as far as if people would be friendly or not. This was a town that should have been friendly. Keep your finger here, but let's turn over to Leviticus 19. And notice a command that God had given to the children of Israel on taking care of one another. Leviticus 19, verse 33 says, and if a stranger dwells with you in your land, you shall not mistreat him. The stranger who dwells among you shall be to you as one born among you. You shall love him as yourself. For you are strangers in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. And God says you need to take care of people. You know, you got a stranger in town, somebody passing through, you need to look out for them. You need to take care of them just like they were your own child. Turning back here to the book of Judges, you know, we see that's not what happened. Now, God gave this command because, again, there wasn't just safe hotels you could check into. There were robbers, there were thieves, highwaymen, as they were called at that time, that would prey on people that were traveling like this. And we see that's exactly what happens. So picking the story back up in Judges 19 and verse 16, it says, "Just then an old man came in from his work in the field at evening, who also was from the mountain of Ephraim. He was staying in Gibeah, whereas the men of the place were Benjamites." Okay, so here's an Ephraimite, another person from the tribe of Benjamin, from the family of Israel, who's working in the area. He's not a Benjamite, but he's there. And he says, verse 17, it says, "And when he raised his eyes, he saw the traveler in the open square of the city. And the old man said, 'Where are you going and where do you come from?'" So he makes some talk. "Hey, how you doing? Where are you from? Where are you headed to?" Verse 18, he says, "So he said to him, 'We are passing from Bethlehem in Judah toward the remote mountains of Ephraim. I am from there. I went to Bethlehem in Judah. Now I am going to the house of the Lord. But there is no one who will take me into his house.'" Verse 19 says, "Although we have both straw and fodder for our donkeys and bread and wine for myself and for your female servant and for the young man who is with your servant, there is no lack of anything." He says, well, we've got, a way to get there, and we'll get there eventually, but, basically we've got no place to sleep tonight. Verse 20, "The old man said, 'Peace be with you. However, let all your needs be my responsibility. Only do not spend the night in the open square.' So he brought him into his house, gave fodder to the donkeys, and they washed their feet and ate and drank." So this old man adhered to the commandment to make sure that this stranger in town was taken care of. Now, it wasn't really his town, but he was doing what he was taught there in Leviticus 19, that you take care of people as they are passing through. Now, from here, the story gets much worse, and we'll summarize it for time. The men of the town come to the man's house, and they ask for the man, and they say they want to know him carnally. In other words, they wanted to rape this man. And the old man says, no, don't do that. He actually offers to give his own daughters up to protect this person who's staying with him. Eventually, the concubine, the man's fiance, gets thrown out, and she is abused by the men of the town all night to the point where she actually dies. When all is said and done, this man, this Levite who's traveling through, takes this concubine's body, he cuts it up into pieces, and he sends one piece to every tribe of the nation of Israel. And he basically says, look at what happened. Look what happened to my family, my household here, while we were in this town that is supposed to be controlled by the tribe of Benjamin. Well, the rest of the nation of Israel knew what that meant. They came forth and they began a civil war, and the tribe of Benjamin was nearly annihilated. It was really cut down to size. It did survive, but it was nearly annihilated. There's a lot of sin that we could look at in this story. A lot of things we could pick out, a lot of problems that were going on. But notice what precipitated the events. Back in 19, verse 18, halfway through it says, "There is no one who will take me into the house." No, that was a command. That was something they were supposed to do. Now, if you wanted to divide this up into what type of sin it was, I guess you could say this is a sin of omission. They should have done something, and they didn't do it. But what it comes down to, in essence, is a lust of the flesh on the part of the people in the town. They said, we can't be bothered to take care of this man. We got a roof over our heads. We have protection. We're fine. Hold numero uno. I got a place to sleep. I'm safe. Let this person take care of themselves. Do we ever put ourselves before other people? Now, of course, we all need to provide for ourselves. I'm not saying that, I need to go make my neighbor's mortgage payment before I make mine. We need to provide to ourselves, but do things get to the point to where we think only about ourselves. Think back last year to when the pandemic first started. What did everybody run out of right away? Toilet paper. Why? Because people were buying, you know, cartons full, whatever, 96 rolls of toilet paper for one person. You know, and they were hoarding these things. This week with gasoline. No doubt you've seen the video of the person who's taking the plastic grocery bag and filling it with gasoline. And it starts leaking, so they double bag it and stick it in their trunk. You know, it's not going to work. Gasoline's going to eat through that bag in a matter of minutes. She can't possibly use it. But, you know, she was hoarding it. They were thinking about themselves. Thinking about themselves, not others. And now, but be careful, you know, maybe she was trying to take that gas to a neighbor or something like that. Maybe it was just a poor choice. I don't know. But certainly we've seen it through the pandemic where people have hoarded things for themselves. You know, this manifests itself in other ways at times. You know, maybe after services, you know, somebody, oh, well, I need to talk to the pastor about XYZ, you know, sort of an issue. So they go after services and they corner the pastor for 30 minutes and nobody else can talk to him. You know, I'm here to talk to people and I'm here to help and do whatever I can. But, you know, if somebody is hoarding all of someone else's time and nobody else gets a chance to talk to them, you know, they're looking out for themselves. You know, if you've got an issue, certainly please come and talk to me. But there's going to be a time where we say, hey, you know what? Maybe we need to make a phone call later in the week. All these things are examples to lusts of the flesh. Looking out for number one. I got to take care of me. So what's the cure for this? What's the cure for this lust of the flesh or self-centeredness? There's an allegory that Jesus Christ uses in the New Testament. It's found in Luke 19. You can begin turning there. And it illustrates a point about someone who is self-centered. Now let's talk about what an allegory is. An allegory is a story that's told to make a point. Somewhat like a parable, but oftentimes allegories are exaggerated or fantasy. You know, the story of Jack and the Beanstalk, right? There's no such thing as magic beans or the goose that laid the golden egg, right? But it's a story told, exaggerated, to sort of make a point. And that's what we see about this allegory here in Luke chapter 19. Luke chapter 19. Oops, I wrote that down wrong. Verse 19, but it's chapter, is that chapter? Bear with me just one moment. Well, I apologize, I wrote it down, but it's the story of Lazarus and the rich man. And so Jesus Christ is telling this story of the rich man who fared sumptuously every day. And there was Lazarus, the poor man, who saw what the rich man had to eat, and he just wished that he could just have the crumbs that fell to the floor. But, you know, the rich man didn't pay any attention to what was going on with this poor man. They die and they go into Hades. Again, this is where the story gets into being an allegory. Jesus Christ is not teaching there's Hades and heaven and hell, everlasting torment, you know, and fire, or you know, heaven in the sense of playing a harp and floating on a cloud. But that was the popular thought of the day. So Jesus Christ is telling and relating this story about Lazarus and the rich man. So they die there in this place, and the rich man is being tormented because of his selfishness. While the poor man is sitting there, it says in the arms of Abraham, and he's enjoying the afterlife, you know, basically, so to speak. And the rich man says to Lazarus, if I could just get one sip of water, you know, on my burning tongue, because it's just hot and tormented over here. And they say, no, there's a great divide and gulf. And he says, well, can I at least warn my brothers, you know, not to do as I have done here? And Jesus says, no, the time of judgment is now. And if your brothers didn't listen then, they're not going to listen now. But what it's pointing out to is that this rich man, you know, he cared about numero uno. He saw new Lazarus is out there starving in the street. But, you know, he would eat and fared sumptuously every day, it says, and the crumbs would fall to the earth and give it to the dogs. Well, he totally neglected the needs of the poor. So we see there then an example of looking out for flesh. For their own flesh, by the way, that's Luke 16, verse 19, but we've already kind of gone through it now. Again, it's an allegory, a story given to tell a point. What then can we learn from this? What do we see from this story of the town of Gibeah and from the rich man and Lazarus? You know, whether it's putting ourselves first because we can't be bothered to help others, or simply because we just want to keep the best for ourselves, we can be led by that lust of the flesh to sin. To counteract this potential form of lust, we need to be thinking about, praying for, and considering the interests of others. That's how we can combat this first form of lust that John speaks about in 1 John 2, verse 16, the lust of the flesh. Let's move on then to the second form of lust he talks about, and that is the lust of the eyes. Quite simply, this is the lust for everything we see. We can read about this in the story of Elijah's servant, Gehazi, when he is healing Naaman's leprosy. Let's turn back to 2 Kings. Just summarize part of the story again for sake of time. Naaman was a powerful commander in the Syrian army. The king of Syria had a young Israelite servant girl that suggests that Naaman go and see Elijah to see if he can heal him. So let's pick it up, 2 Kings 5, verse 5. And of course, she mentioned the issue that he was going to be healed of is the fact that Naaman was a leper. He had leprosy. He was still functional, so, you know, apparently the leprosy wasn't that severe yet. He still served as commander of the Assyrian army, but he was looking for healing. And so the king's servant girl, this Israelite girl, suggests he goes and sees Elijah. So let's pick up the story in verse 5 of 2 Kings 5. It says, and the king of Syria said, go now, and I will send a letter to the king of Israel. So he departed and took with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 changes of clothing. Now, Naaman was taking with him something to pay for this healing. I heard Mr. Carswell up in the Hickory congregation in a sermonette refer to this one time as his copay. So you might think of it in that regards. He was taking a copay with him. Now, we know God doesn't heal that way. God doesn't heal based on how much we pay. He heals based on faith and on his will. And indeed, if you read through the rest of the story, we see that Elijah wouldn't take the money because Elijah realized that he wasn't the one who was doing any healing. It was God that had done it. It was through his will that it was done. But in the process of this whole act being played out, Gehazi, Elijah's servant's kind of sitting there watching it, and he sees these talents of silver, these changes of clothes, and he says, man, that looks good. That looks real good. I'd look real good in that, too. Verse 14. See, I was still in 2 Kings 5. It says, so he went down and dipped 7 times in the Jordan, according to the saying of the man of God, and his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. So Naaman is healed because he does exactly as Elijah had instructed him. It says, and he returned to the man of God, he and his aides, and came and stood before him and said, indeed, now I know that there is no God in all the earth except in Israel. Now, therefore, please take a gift from your servant. But he said, as the Lord lives, before whom I stand, I will receive nothing. And he urged him to take it, that is, Naaman urges Elijah to take it, but he refused. No, Elijah probably could have named his price. You know, he could have looked at everything that Naaman had brought and said, meh, this is a good start. This will hold me over for now, but why don't you bring me back, you know, a few more things. He could have named his price. Naaman had the ability, had the means to pay whatever it was that Elijah would have asked, but he said, no, you know, I can't do that. This impresses Naaman so much that he goes on, says, you know what, I'm not going to worship any of the false gods, the pagan gods I've been worshiping. I'm going to worship the one true God of Israel. It's actually a very impressive story. But unfortunately, while all this was going on, the lust of the eyes was growing in Gehazi. If we read in verse 20, it says, but Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said, look, my master has spared Naaman this Syrian while not receiving from his hands what he brought. But as the Lord lives, I will run after him and take something from him. You know, it's quite ironic here, I think, that Gehazi actually swears in the name of the Lord that he's going to go back and take this payment. So he's kind of doing, creating more sin for himself by doing that. But he looks at all this stuff and he says, you know what? Naaman brought all this stuff. He was willing to give it all up. What's it going to hurt if I just take a few things? No biggie, right? So he goes and he does so. Verse 21 says, so Gehazi pursued Naaman, and when Naaman saw him running after him, he got down from the chariot to meet him and said, is all well? And he said, all is well. My master sent me, saying, indeed, just now two young men of the sons of the prophets have come to me from the mountains of Ephraim. Please give them a talent of silver and two changes of garments. So Naaman said, please take two talents. He urged him, found two talents of silver and two bags with two changes of garments, and handed them to two of his servants, and they carried him on ahead of him. When he came to the citadel, he took them from their hand and stored them away in the house. Then he let the men go, and they departed. Now he went and stood before his master Elisha, said to him, where did you go, Gehazi? And he said, your servant did not go anywhere. So now starts the cover-up. You know, Naaman sends back some soldiers to help carry all of this. And when they get close, Gehazi says, I got it from here, boys. I'll take it. Y'all just go on home. And that way they don't see the fact that there are no young men. He goes and he takes it and hides it. Elisha walks in at some point and says, what's going on here? Gehazi says, I'm not doing anything. See how one sin often compounds and starts to build on another and another and another? You know, that's what we're seeing here. You know, Gehazi couldn't resist what his eyes saw. Verse 26, it says, then he said to him, did not my heart go with you when the man turned back from his chariot to meet you? Is it time to receive money and receive clothing, olive groves and vineyards, sheep and oxen, male and female servants? He says, we don't do this for money, Gehazi. You know, we're not told exactly what the role was. Was Gehazi perhaps being trained to be a prophet, a servant of God? We don't know. But Elisha says, it's not why we do this. We don't do it for the money. It says, therefore the leprosy of Naaman shall cling to you and your descendants forever. And he went out from his presence leprous, as white as snow. So Gehazi winds up receiving that leprosy. And he receives a punishment for his sins. I'd like to go back and read 1 John 2, verse 16, this time from the Contemporary English Version. The Contemporary English Version says this. It says, our foolish pride comes from this world, and so do our selfish desires and our desire to have everything we see. None of this comes from the Father. You know, the lust of the eyes is the most basic form of lust. It's that sort of lust that is this sexual desire to see, you know, a beautiful woman and lust after her, or to see a bottle of alcohol and say, wow, you know, I need to drink all that. When I'm done with that, I need to drink more of it. You know, it's the inability to resist buying that new car we can't afford, or having that second piece of cake for dessert we know we really shouldn't have. In short, it's the inability to say no to ourselves. It's the inability to say no to ourselves. We read James 1 earlier. Perhaps that's what we think of the most when we read through that cycle of sin. You know, we're tempted, we have desire. We succumb to that temptation. We sin, and the result is death. Certainly that would apply to any sin, but I think perhaps maybe most directly relatable to the lust of the eyes. So how can we deal with this particular form of lust? Well, Jesus Christ gives us an answer in Mark chapter 10. Mark chapter 10. Mark chapter 10, we'll start in verse 17. Mark 10, verse 17. It says, "Now as he was going out on the road, one came running, knelt before him, and asked him, 'Good teacher, what shall I do that I may inherit eternal life?' So Jesus said to him, 'Why do you call me good? No one is good but one, that is God. You know the commandments: do not commit adultery, do not murder, do not steal, do not bear false witness, do not defraud, honor your father and mother.' And he answered and said to him, 'Teacher, all these things I have kept from my youth.'" Now, one of the things I first learned when I went to the ministry is that when you're asked a nickel question, give a nickel answer. Now, the young man asks a basic question. Jesus Christ gives a basic answer. Young man asks, "What do I do to inherit eternal life?" Jesus Christ says, "Keep all the commandments." But it goes farther. Verse 20 says, "He answered and said to him, 'Teacher, all these things I've kept from my youth.' Then Jesus, looking at him, loved him and said to him," he says he looked at him and he loved him. You know, you and I don't have the ability to judge people by looking at them. We can't discern the heart. You know, that's an ability that Jesus Christ did. But you know, you can look at people sometimes, you can kind of size up the situation. And Jesus Christ did so perfectly. You know, we don't know what exactly happened, what exactly saw, but maybe this man was wearing, you know, very nice jewelry, very nice clothes. You know, maybe he pulled up in a 550 horsepower supercharged camel with 22-inch rims on it. We don't know, but Jesus sized him up, and he sized him up correctly. And he said, "You know, one thing you lack. Go your way, sell whatever you have, and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven, and come, take up the cross, and follow me." But he was sad at this word and went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions. Now, Jesus Christ looked at this man and he sized him up and he recognized, you know, this fellow has never had to say no to anything he ever wanted. Anything and everything in his life he wanted, he was able to get. Go out and buy it. Do whatever. And Jesus Christ says, "You know what? If you really want eternal life, you need to give that up. You need to develop the ability to say no to yourself." Now, all these things that this young man found pleasure in, these treasures on earth, he found, Jesus Christ recognized, says, "You know what? You need to say no sometimes. You need to say no to yourself and your desires. Not just get yourself everything you want to see." And I think that's an example for us. You know, sometimes we just need to say no. Yeah, sure, maybe I can, you know, eat that second piece of cake for dessert, but do I really need to do that? You know, yeah, maybe I can go out and take a loan and you know, stretch my credit and buy that, you know, brand new car that costs $60,000, but do I really need to do that? Is that really the best use of my money? If I am working and every single dime of my money is going to make this car payment or whatever, you know, I've become a slave to that car payment. Romans 6 reminds us we are a slave of the one we obey. And if it takes everything we have just to make a car payment or whatever, we recognize, okay, you know, this isn't good. To deal with this particular form of lust, the lust of the eyes, sometimes we just need to learn to say no to ourselves. To say, no, you know what, I don't need that. I need to put away those physical possessions, those things that I have a tendency to put too much value on, or those physical feelings that I have too much a tendency to put too much desire into. So that's the lust of the eyes. brings us to the last thing that John talked about. That's the pride of life. The pride of life. And the pride of life can be characterized as things that go beyond just physical pleasure and material goods. It's the look at me factor. I want other people to see what I am, who I am, what I have. You know, we see this in the political world, certainly. We see it all around us. It doesn't stay confined to that part of life, though. We see it's happened in church over the years. It's the cause for many of the splits that we've seen at times. Let's read a biblical example of a couple that actually was struggling with this issue, this pride of life, it seems. That's over in the book of Acts. Acts chapter 5. Again, we have to be extremely careful about making judgments on those we read about in the Bible. But you know, when the Bible lays out a judgment for us, we can be sure and know that it's true. And we're going to see that the judgment of this couple is laid out very clearly. Acts chapter 5. Begin in verse 1. It says, "But a certain man named Ananias, with Sapphira his wife, sold a possession, and he kept back part of the proceeds, his wife also being aware of it, and brought a certain part of it, and laid it at the apostles' feet." So they had a piece of land, they sold it, they knew how much they got it for it, but they decided to keep a certain portion back of it, and then it seems they made a big show to lay it at the feet of the apostles and say, "Look at the generous gift that we are giving." Verse 3, it says, "But Peter said, Ananias, why has Satan filled your hearts to lie to the Holy Spirit and keep back part of the price of the land for yourself? While it remained, was it not your own? After it was sold, was it not in your own control? Why have you conceived this thing in your heart? You have not lied to men, but to God." So it seems then that the whole conversation isn't recorded here. But we get a summary. You know, apparently there was a big show that went on, and Ananias was trying to lead the apostles to believe that he was being very pious, very humble. He had sold it, you know, for $10,000 or whatever, and he was giving all $10,000 to charity out of the generosity of his very kind and humble heart. You know, whenever somebody tells you they have a kind and humble heart, the red flags go up. Certainly, they went up for Peter here. The Holy Spirit revealed to Peter that there was something more. And Peter says, you know, it was your land. You could have kept it. When you sold it and you got the money for it, you could have kept the money. But instead, you know, they lied. They tried to make it look like they were giving it all when they were only giving a portion. "Then Ananias, hearing these words, fell down and breathed his last. So great fear came upon all those who heard these things." Now again, we're not casting judgment on Ananias, but reading exactly what happened here, the words of Peter and how the man fell down dead, and we're going to see that happen shortly to his wife as well, seems that God judged him. And what Peter is saying is right on point here. We won't read the rest of the story, but again, the same thing happened to his wife. But notice what Peter said in verse 4. He said, "Why have you conceived this thing in your heart?" Why have you conceived this thing in your heart? Now, given what we are told here and the results, what happened, that God did kill them both right there on the spot, it seems that they conceived this in their heart over the pride of life. They wanted to look good in front of Peter, the other apostles, the whole congregation, and say, "Look how generous and loving and great of a person I am." You know, do we ever have a tendency to want others to look at us? I think we all like to be recognized for things we do. We appreciate, you know, if we make a joke and somebody laughs at it, or if we do something kind, we appreciate the fact that they say, "Well, thank you, that was very generous," or something like that. But, you know, do we have pride and vanity that ever creeps in and says, "Man, I just want people to look at me"? Let me ask you this. You ever do any online shopping? My guess is if you didn't do it before, this past year you learned to do it. You know, maybe you're looking for a new pair of shoes. Your old pair of tennis shoes is worn out. So I said, well, I need a new pair of shoes. You know, I go online and start looking. It costs $40, $50. And pops up, you find the shoes you want. And then a little ad comes over on the side and says, hey, you know, there's a matching socks you can buy for these shoes. Cost you another 10 bucks. I said, hey, well, that's not a bad deal. I'll do that. And then you say, well, wait a minute. You know, those socks and shoes, look. There's a set of workout shorts that go with it. Oh, and this jacket. Man, I'd look good in that. I'd look really good in that. You know, we see actually two things going on here. We see the lust of the eyes. Everything you see. Oh, wow, that looks good. I want that. That looks good. I want that. That looks good. I want that. You know, what's driving it? Man, I want people to look at me. I want to look good. And so we go ahead and click on buy now. We started off looking for $50 worth of shoes. We wind up with $150 worth of clothing. And then the bill comes. Bill comes, we can't pay it, so what do we do? Well, I guess I'm going to have to skip on tithing this month. You see how easily these things can compound. See how easily they can add up. Small little things like that can lead us to sin. It wasn't intentional, you know, but we got caught up in that pride of life for just that moment. And then we got caught up in the lust of the eyes, and then the lust of the flesh, and it all builds. So how do we address this? How do we address this? Well, once again, we see Jesus Christ gives the example, gives the answer, and we see that actually back in Mark 10, where we were earlier. So let's go back to Mark 10. Mark 10, we're going to pick it up in verse 35. Mark 10, verse 35. It says, then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him, saying, Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. You know, again, when somebody comes up to you and says, don't ask questions, I just need you to do whatever I say. You know, the red flags usually pop up. We usually think, what's going on here? That seems like a little unusual. Verse 36, he said to him, what do you want me to do for you? Verse 37, notice, by the way, Jesus Christ wisely didn't say, sure, I'll do it. He asked, what do you want me to do? Verse 37, he says, then they said to him, grant us that we may sit one on your right hand and the other on your left in your glory. Now, it's not too hard to read between the lines here. When they say, in your glory, you know, they're wanting to bask in Jesus Christ's glory. They want to join in his glory and have some of that for themselves, it would seem. Again, we've got to be careful we don't judge people, but as we read through what Jesus Christ answers, I think it's pretty clear that's what they were seeking. Verse 38, Jesus said to them, you do not know what you ask. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink and baptize with the baptism I am to be baptized with? They said to him, we are able. Jesus said, you will indeed drink the cup that I drink, and with the baptism I am baptized with, you will be baptized. But to sit on my right hand and on the left is not mine to give, but is for those for whom it is prepared. And when the 10 heard it, they began to be greatly displeased with James and John. So there's trouble back at the ranch here. People hear this and they say, wow, these guys, you know, they're looking out for number one. You know, we might say there's a little bit of lust of flesh here, or at least that was what they perceived. But out of this, Jesus Christ sees an important opportunity to teach, and one that we can take a great lesson from when it comes to looking at our own pride, of our station in life, of what our title might be, or where we might serve. Verse 42, Jesus called them to himself and said, you know that those who are considered rulers over the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. Yet it shall not be so among you. Now that's a simple phrase, but I think it holds great meaning. You know, it's a compare and a contrast moment. Jesus Christ says, you know, the pride of life, the pride of race, of station, of whatever it is, of title, of authority, people hold this up here. Said, but for you, it's not supposed to be like that. In fact, he says, you're not up here equal to that. He says, no. He says, be down here. Down here.
He said, verse 44, "And whosoever of you desires to be first shall be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as ransom for many." And we often call this servant leadership. Certainly you see the example of it when Jesus Christ washed the apostles' feet there at that final New Testament, or that final Passover that Jesus Christ observed there in the New Testament. He says, serve others. Serve others. And it's in that that we see the key to counteract the pride of life. He said, don't worry about advancing your own position. He said, instead, serve others. Focus on others. Focus on God, serving his people with a humble servant heart. When we do that, we are providing ourselves the natural antidote to the pride of life. We all have tendencies to do things in life that we don't want to do. The Apostle Paul wrote about that in Romans 7. We won't turn there for sake of time, but he said, the things that I don't want to do, that's what I do. And the things that I want to do, I somehow left undone. Hopefully, by better understanding these types of lusts that drive us to sin, we can do a better job of not succumbing to our sins and not having to ask ourselves, why did I do that? When we have a lust of the flesh, providing for ourselves, looking out for numero uno, we need to look at others and think, what do others need? What is it that they need right now? When we have a lust of the eyes, when we see something and we covet it in a sinful way, we need to practice just saying no to ourselves, to deny ourselves those things. Not to say that we deny ourselves of every pleasurable thing, but there's times when we need to say, no, you know, I just don't need that right now. And when the pride of life creeps in, when the desire to be seen or be heard above others, it's time to take a back seat and ask, you know what? What can I better do to serve other people? By doing all of these things, we can begin to move past lust and pride, begin to focus on what's truly important. Let's conclude today, back in 1 John 2, with the very next verse, in fact. 1 John 2, we'll read verse 16 again, since it's kind of our core verse for the day. And then we'll finish with verse 17. 1 John 2, verse 16 says, "For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world is passing away." All those things we lust for, you know, whether it's new clothes, whether it's to be seen by others, whether it's, you know, a sexual encounter with someone, none of it lasts. It all just passes away. It says, "And the world is passing away in the lust of it, but he who does the will of God abides forever." If we focus on the will of God, on looking out for the interests of others, on being able to deny ourselves when we are just lusting after things that we see, and if we focus on how we can serve others, we can do as we are instructed here and abide forever with God.